This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
All engine running. Absolute genius.
Get this.
Welcome.
This is the show where we bring you
science.
What that essentially means is
discovery,
advances,
questions,
research,
technology.
Unbelievable.
Without further ado,
this is The Naked Scientists. Hello, welcome to this week's Naked Scientists, the show where we strive to bring you the latest breakthroughs in science, technology and medicine. I'm Chris Smith, and coming up, a vaccine developed by Cambridge scientists to help you build immunity against infections that may not even exist yet. Also, why you might not have to lick a toad to alleviate depression in the future. And the super Earth exoplanet called 55 Cancri E. Space scientists have discovered their first rocky planet with an atmosphere around a nearby star.
From Cambridge University's Institute of Continuing Education, this is The Naked Scientists.
We begin this week with research from the University of Cambridge, where scientists have developed a new vaccine technology which they believe could provide protection against a range of new coronaviruses, including those that may not even exist yet. It's hoped that the discovery could help to curb future pandemics. And it works by gluing key pieces of the virus outer coat that are shared by many different members of the virus family onto injected nanoparticles. These train the immune system to recognise them. Here's Rory Hills from the University of Cambridge's Department of Pharmacology.
There are a variety of other coronaviruses in the same family that are lurking in bats and pangolins and other mammals that have the chance to cross over to humans. And so our vision is to have a vaccine that can protect against those before they've actually crossed over to humans.
One scientist scarily told me during COVID that there are probably as many as 5,000 members of the coronavirus family, quite a high fraction of which might jump the species barrier. So you're pushing on an open door, I'd say. How do you do it?
So we use a protein nanoparticle as the basis of our vaccine, and then we attach parts of different viruses to that same nanoparticle. The trick is we create a mosaic of all these different viruses, and when you immunize with that, you train the immune system to go after the parts of those viruses that are shared. And if we can train the immune system to go after those shared parts, we can protect against all of those viruses we have on the vaccine, but also against ones that aren't present and are just related.
Because those things, even though you've not seen them, have still got that same core part that those other things you did train the immune system on had. And so you make a response that indirectly protects you against those.
Exactly right, yes.
Didn't some people argue that during COVID that was sort of naturally happening, in the sense that there were some people who didn't get the virus or didn't get it badly, and they made the case that those individuals had perhaps had one of the other common coronavirus infections and made a response to it that happened to protect them because they'd made a response to some of the bits that those other common coronaviruses share with the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID?
That's my understanding, yeah. So of the 7 coronaviruses that infect humans, 4 of them cause the common cold. And there are regions of those spike proteins on those common cold coronaviruses that can provide protection against SARS-CoV-2.
So when you're trying to make your vaccines, how do you spot the bit that you're going to put onto your nanoparticle? How do you say, well, I'm going to have that bit and that's going to be a really good bit to go for?
So we have been very conventional in that approach. We've just used the receptor binding domain of the spike protein, the RBD, and that's the tip of the spear. And that
this is on SARS-CoV-2.
On SARS-CoV-2, yes, yeah. So then we've taken that same protein on all of the other coronaviruses. And then the trick is we haven't necessarily gone through and tried to pick out the parts that we're trying to target. Just by the nature of having these 8 different proteins on the nanoparticle, we train the immune system to go after the parts that are shared. So we don't have to know going in what those parts are.
Does it work?
It works remarkably well. It works better than we were initially anticipating. When we immunize animals with our vaccine, we end up getting responses that are neutralizing against the viruses included, and then also viruses not included. In fact, I've created a version of our vaccine that doesn't have COVID, doesn't have any closely related viruses to COVID, and we're still able to get a very strong response against COVID with that vaccine.
So you mentioned you vaccinated animals. So you put this in and they presumably make antibodies. How do you then make sure they're protected against this range of viruses?
So there's three main outputs. The first one is the easiest one. That's just making sure that the antibodies that they make bind the proteins that the virus produces. We use something called an ELISA for that. The second one is called a pseudovirus neutralization assay. So we have essentially a modified version of the virus that's not dangerous. It just carries the single protein from a coronavirus. And we look at that ability to infect human cells in a dish when we add sera from mice that we've immunized with our vaccine.
And that's got the antibodies in it, that sera. So you're then able to say, well, look, if that blocks that, then were that in the animal for real, they would be protected.
Exactly. And the third way is that we take the actual COVID-19 virus and look at its ability to infect human cells in a dish. And we look at the protection that is conferred by the antibodies that we've raised in mice.
And that works?
It works brilliantly, yeah. And I think if we think much more long term, the vision is that you could have a library of pre-existing vaccines that protect against a group of viruses, have them validated for safety and efficacy and on the shelf ready to go in case of a future pandemic.
People have been trying to do this for flu for decades. When I was a medical student, people were trying to do this and make the uni flu vaccine. Can you now turn this on challenges like flu?
I mean, that's certainly something that we're really interested in. And I think it's something that we definitely want to strive for. A universal flu vaccine is a very substantial challenge. Flu has been with us for a very long time. It's diversified incredibly. And it's not just a matter of getting antibodies to bind. We also want to have them actually able to neutralize the virus. So
you're saying flu is a harder nut to crack?
I think so.
But he has done very well with coronaviruses so far, hasn't he? That was Rory Hills, and his study has just come out in the journal Nature Nanotechnology. In 2022, the US National Park Service were urging people to please stop licking Sonoran desert toads. The warning came because the amphibians, which are frequently also called Colorado River toads, secrete a venom from glands on their back that can ward off predators. But now, a new study published in Nature suggests that a modified version of the venom might prove effective for treatment-resistant depression and anxiety symptoms that don't respond to traditional antidepressant medicines. Up to one person in three meets this definition, but not everyone can tolerate the hallucinogenic effects. The researchers suspect that the toad chemical is activating two different brain pathways, one that produces the hallucinatory experiences, while the other is the depression buster. So they've modified the molecule to lock on to just the desirable one. David Nutt, a professor of neuropsychopharmacology and chair of drug science at Imperial College London, works on very similar research in his lab, so we asked him to take us through the new results.
Well, there's a great need for new treatments in psychiatry. There's been very little innovation from pharma companies over the last 20 years. The biggest and most exciting development has come from academics, like my own group, using psychedelics. And there's really good evidence now that these can lift depression where other treatments have failed. Now, there are different sorts of psychedelics. There are sort of classic ones that people have heard of, like LSD. But there are others, popular with aficionados, but not so well known. And one of them is a molecule called 5-methoxy-DMT, which comes from, amongst other sources, the Sonora Desert toad. The toad secretes this molecule, probably as a deterrent to other animals eating it, because they get quite powerful hallucinations. Now, 5-methoxy-DMT has been known for some time to be a powerful hallucinogen in humans. And like other psychedelic, serotonergic psychedelics, LSD, psilocybin, DMT, it has a potential utility for the treatment of depression. But there is a lot of concern amongst investors and to some extent amongst some patients that a psychedelic trip might be challenging, particularly in depressed people. And when in fact it is, there's no question. So there is a feeling that if we could get the therapeutic benefit of psychedelics without the trip, that would be a major advance, which of course it would.
Do you think it would be possible to divorce the two? Do you have to have the psychedelic element to get the therapeutic depression-busting element? Or are they mediated through two different routes in the brain and it's just because the molecules activate both, you end up with both, but you don't need both?
Well, that's the hope. My own personal view, and certainly our own research supports this, is that the magnitude of the psychedelic experience is predictive of the outcome, but I cannot prove that. And one thing that is clear is the pharmacology of psychedelic drugs is not just at the serotonin 2A receptor, the psychedelic receptor. There's also an activity through another serotonin receptor called the 5-HT1A receptor. And we've long known that this receptor is involved in the brain circuits relating particularly to stress. And in fact, it's very likely that the antidepressant effects of classic antidepressants like the SSRIs are mediated through enhancing activity at the serotonin 1A receptor. So it's a different kind of antidepressant effect with some unwanted deleterious actions like some blunting of emotions, but it's unquestionably a target for antidepressants.
So what did they do here to try to shed a bit more light on this?
Well, what they're trying to do, as many groups are, is to try to get an antidepressant effect through these current hallucinogens, psychedelics, without having hallucinatory effects. So they have taken this 5-methoxydimethyltryptamine molecule and they have put it through a very sophisticated and, you know, very beautiful series of in silico receptor interactions, looking at how the molecule and variants of the molecule, predicted variants of the molecule, chemical variants, will interact with the protein structure of the receptor. And it's extremely high quality, which you might call molecular chemical pharmacology. And from that, they've come up with a couple of molecules which have specific activity at the 1A receptor, but without activity at the 5-HT2A receptor. So they have taken the toad venom and turned it into something that is not hallucinogenic, but they believe may still be antidepressant.
And is this purely still in the mind's eye of a computer, or have they actually got the molecule and have they put it into a brain yet?
Well, they've definitely got the molecules and they've definitely put them into mice and they've definitely shown some impact on tests of depression and anxiety. They have shown that.
So the next step, I suppose, then, is to go the sort of route that you and others have gone, which is to start physically testing this in real-life patients to see if you still get this therapeutic effect without the scary hallucinogenic effects.
That is the next step. The problem is the compound they have invented is very similar to a compound that was made by Dufar, a drug company that's no longer with us, with exactly the same theory 30 years ago. And it didn't work very well in depression, had quite a lot of side effects. So I think it's pretty implausible, frankly, that their new molecules are going to have any real clinical benefit. But of course, it has to be tested, and I may be wrong.
And of course, there are people who don't rely on pharmaceutical companies. They go to the source itself because there is a trend of people licking toads and have done for centuries, possibly, to get these effects. That's true, isn't it?
That is true, but I want to say, please don't ever use 5-methoxy-DMT from a toad. People seeking out 5-MeO, as we call it, should not source it from the toad. It can be sourced from plants. So please do not use the toad. Otherwise, the toads will be extinct. The second thing is, people using 5-methoxy are doing so because it produces a very powerful, rather strange, slightly different hallucinatory effects to psilocybin and LSD. And we're currently studying that. No one's actually ever done a brain imaging study of the 5-MeO yet. So we're starting that at Imperial literally this week. We'll find out whether it does have the same signatures in the brain as other 5-HC2A agonists. But what you cannot get is you cannot get from a toad or anything else, any other living species, the molecule that they're testing. This is a fluorinated molecule. It's not made in nature. And so you cannot get what they're getting. It has to be made in a lab.
Fascinating story, isn't it? David Nutt there. That study has just come out in the journal nature.
The Naked Scientists podcast is produced in association with Spitfire, cost-effective voice, internet and IP engineering services for UK businesses. Find out how Spitfire can empower your company at spitfire.co.uk.
Music in the programme is sponsored by Epidemic Sound, perfect music for audio and video productions.
You're listening to The Naked Scientists with me, Chris Smith. On the way, what the James Webb Space Telescope has revealed about a super-Earth exoplanet. Before that, though, archaeologists have found that during the Middle Ages, leprosy was transmitting between red squirrels and humans. This was revealed following a study of squirrel bones and human remains in the English city of Winchester. I've been speaking to Sarah Inskip, who's a bioarchaeologist at the University of Leicester and co-authored the new study.
About 8 years ago, people found that modern British red squirrels were infected with a strain of leprosy that had infected humans in medieval England. And we were really interested to try and find out how these modern British red squirrels effectively had a strain of a disease that hasn't really been seen in England for about 200 to 300 years. In order to answer this question, we needed to go back.
Well, where did you go back to and how far back?
We went back about 1,000 years, and in particular, we looked at medieval Winchester. One of the reasons why we chose Winchester is because it had a large leprosarium. So this is a hospital that was set up to care for individuals that had the disease. At the same time, we also knew that there was, within the town, a fur trader's street where there were the archaeological remains of lots of red squirrels. So we picked this place because we had circulating leprosy in humans, and then we had the opportunity to look at, well, is it also circulating in the red squirrels at this time, and is there possibility for transmission between the two?
Were squirrels very much part of the fur trade back in those days then?
Yes, it's actually really strange. We don't think of squirrels as being sort of important fur animals, but they were really important for over 1,000 years in England in terms of lining garments. People would line them up, the white to the grey, to make these very pretty sort of fur-lined trims. And so, yeah, it was far more important than I even thought was possible.
So your theory would be that the squirrels are brought in, and what the leprosy is in the squirrels that get used for their fur, or that just the fact that they are around humans and humans have got leprosy, it got into the squirrels from us. Do you know which way round it was likely to have been?
This is one of the really important questions. And actually, we don't know which way round it would have occurred because people kept them as pets as well. At some point, someone would have been working with live squirrels to get the skins processed, and then people would have been working with the skins to make it ready for a garment. Each one of those would allow transmission in both directions as well. We still want to try and find out.
So what did you have to work with from ancient Winchester, and how did you study it?
So from Winchester, we had access to the individuals that had leprosy within the leprosarium. And it's quite a big leprosarium, and it has individuals that span a number of years. And we were able to extract their teeth and look in the pulp chamber where you have the blood that circulates in and out of teeth. We were able to look for the DNA of the leprosy-causing pathogen within that chamber from the humans. But from the squirrels, we were limited to a farrier's pit. And a farrier's pit is a fur trader pit where they're processing the fur. They remove bits that they didn't need. And that was the hands and feet that often get stuck to the fur. The human side was fine. We had plenty of material, but we only had hands and feet of squirrels to do this. And for us, it was phenomenal that we were able to recover the bacteria that causes leprosy infection from these tiny, tiny bones. We were really, really lucky.
You were looking for the DNA of the Mycobacterium leprae, the bacteria that caused the disease.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, leprosy is caused by a bacterium, and that is Mycobacterium leprae. And we were specifically looking for the DNA of that organism to be able to show that that person or that animal was infected with that bacteria.
How does that prove the fact you've got the genetic code that one organism was giving it to another, i.e. the squirrel was giving it to the human or vice versa?
So we can look at the DNA, and you can think a little bit about family trees, for example. And so we can look at specific segments or parts of the code to see how similar they are between the bacteria that's in the squirrel and the bacteria that's in the human. And we can compare that to all of the other sort of published strains of leprosy bacteria that exist. And what we found is that, I guess, the codes were so similar between the medieval squirrels and the medieval people of Winchester that we can say that there is the same sort of strain circulating between the squirrels and the humans. And what was really interesting is that when we looked at the bacteria that's infecting the modern squirrels, it was distinct enough that there is difference between them. And that actually suggests that it was a different transmission event that modern squirrels have the leprosy from. So for us, it was really cool because we were able to show that not only has this transference happened between human or squirrel and human, it's happened more than once because there's enough differences in the code between the modern and the ancient squirrel.
And I suppose as well as being an important historical message in this, there's also a modern message because we see very similar things with bird flu and with coronaviruses, don't we, where there's a possibility of a two-way street, a trafficking of infection between animals and us.
There is a precedent for this. Leprosy was not present in the Americas until the Europeans went over there. And it got into armadillos in the Americas, where it is still today. But we also know from work on the genetic material from those infected armadillos and the people that do pick it up, that they have picked it back up from armadillos. There's been enough change in that code while in armadillos and then appearing in humans. So we know in that case that it's certainly gone from human to armadillo and back to human. And so in our research, we show this potentially for squirrels. The key message here is that perhaps in places where leprosy is proving difficult to eradicate, we need to maybe go and look at some of the animals that are in the local areas to see if they are acting as hosts for the bacteria so it is able to keep coming back into the human population, or the human population reciprocally can keep infecting them as well, and you have a sort of circular dynamic that goes on.
So you think there might be a reservoir species where we still see, because there's something like 250,000 cases of leprosy around the world every year, isn't there? Everyone thinks it's gone away, but it is still prevalent in some places. And you think that perhaps it's worth a look in nature because there may well be a reservoir, something like a squirrel might be harbouring it and injecting it back into the humans locally.
Yes, absolutely. So for a long time, leprosy was thought to be a human-only disease. With the exception of armadillos, they have a slight quirk in their biology that seems to make them susceptible. So the fact that we found them in effectively what is wild squirrels potentially does suggest that, okay, it does infect more animals than just us, and they may act as a reservoir for this disease. So it could be other rodents, it could be other mammals. So it's certainly worth exploring in these areas where there is eradication efforts, but perhaps it's proven to be persistent.
Amazing what history can still tell us about modern day problems, isn't it? That was Sarah Inskip, and her study has just come out in Current Biology. Well, we're going up into space now, and a new study that's involving the James Webb Space Telescope has found a so-called exoplanet, in other words, a planet orbiting a star outside our own solar system, with what looks like a thick atmosphere around it. Now, this is the first time that anyone has discovered a rocky planet with an atmosphere. And to find out more, I went to meet Matt Bothwell, public astronomer at the University of Cambridge, and asked him to take me through what the new paper shows.
So astronomers for the first time have found an atmosphere around a rocky planet using the James Webb Space Telescope. It's orbiting a star called 55 Cancri. In the slightly ridiculous naming system astronomers use, the planet is 55 Cancri E. It's about 40 light years away or so.
And what do we know about the planet itself?
It's a terrible place to live, we know that for sure. It's a super Earth, about 10 times the mass of Earth. It's a roughly rocky planet, although rocky is probably the wrong word to use. It's so close to its parent star, this planet is certainly a molten blob of lava. It's about a 25th of Mercury's distance to the Sun. This thing is so close to its star, it whizzes around once every 17 hours. So yeah, it's a planet that's made of rock, but yeah, think of a molten blob of lava whizzing around a Sun-like star.
How do we know it's got an atmosphere then?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the team used this very interesting technique called a secondary eclipse. So listeners might have heard of planetary transits. That's when a planet goes in front of a star, and from the missing starlight, that tells you about the planet. In this case, they use the planet going round the back of the star. And the way that can tell us about the planet is that if you imagine the planet just to the side of the star, our telescope will pick up the combined light of the planet and the star all at once. And then when the planet dips behind the star, at that point, we only get the starlight. And by comparing the before and after, you know, the planet plus the star compared to just the star, we can subtract one from the other and get our best guess at what the light from the planet is doing.
So how does that light tell you there's an atmosphere there? And how does it tell you what's in the atmosphere? And indeed, can it?
It can. I think the answer is do some quite complicated modelling. Traditionally in astronomy, when we look at things, we're looking for spectral lines, like these characteristic fingerprints of particular atoms and molecules. That's not what's been done here. So here the team have made some complex models of this planet's atmosphere and tried to reproduce what they saw in this planet's light using this secondary eclipse technique. The best model that fit to the data is a complex mix of carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. So we think that's what's going on.
I understand why you said it's not a home from home now. Not only is it roasting hot and hot enough to melt metal, it's also got an atmosphere that sounds pretty horrible. Why then should we be excited about this discovery?
Well, I think it's still incredibly cool that we have been able to find an atmosphere around a rocky planet. The holy grail for this whole area of science is, of course, discovering life around, like life living on an Earth-like planet. And a big step in that direction is the ability to find atmospheres around rocky planets. And so, yeah, even though this one might not be your ideal holiday destination, I think it's a huge step in the right direction.
It's also not that far away, in the sense that 40 light years away, which is where we think it is in space terms, just around the corner. So does that give us any clues as to the likelihood of finding planets that fit the bill that you've just outlined? How likely it will be, how frequently they are out there?
That's a very good question. It's one of the hot things that exoplanet scientists talk about a lot. There's the parameter which we call eta Earth, which is the fraction of stars that have an Earth-like planet. I think the best guess right now is somewhere between 30 and 50% of stars having something roughly Earth-like. Proxima Centauri, for example, our next-door neighbour in space, has a pretty Earth-like planet. So, yeah, I think the good news is that these things are pretty common.
So watch this space. That study on 55 Cancri E has just come out in the journal Nature. My thanks to the University of Cambridge's Matt Bothwell for talking us through it. Well, now it's time to delve into some organic chemistry and a very interesting question of the week, courtesy of James Titko.
Thanks, Chris. This week's question comes in from listener Jimmy. Why is new plastic flexible but old plastic brittle? Well, Jimmy, thanks for this question. There are, of course, lots of different types of plastic. Some we want to be flexible, as in a plastic bag, or some we want to stay rigid, like a plastic bottle. To start answering your question, we need to understand what accounts for these different properties. And to help me, I've enlisted the help of Philip Broadwith from Chemistry World.
Plastics are polymers. That means they have molecules that are long chains inside them. If you want those polymers to be flexible, those chains need to be able to move over each other when you apply a force. They don't stay still. You can do that in a few different ways. You can either make the chain molecules branched and twiggy. That means they can't pack together so tightly, which means that there's a bit of space between them for them to move as you apply a force. Or some polymers, like silicones, have bonds between the chains, which change how rigid they are. If you think about silicone, you can have it as a kind of almost a paste or liquid when you squeeze your bathroom sealant out of the tube. But then as it cures, what's happening is there's more bonds being made between the chains. So the polymer gets harder and more rigid into a kind of rubbery state. But for the same polymer, if you take it even higher and make more links between the chains, you can make it into a completely rigid polymer. So that's called cross-linking. So the more cross-linking you have, the more rigid the polymer is going to be. The other way that you can do it is to add an additive called a plasticizer, which sits in between the chains and acts almost like a lubricant. There's lots of different types of plasticizer, but the most common one that people will encounter is in PVC. So if you think about window frames, they're made of unplasticized PVC. They're quite rigid. There's not very much plasticizer inside them. But if you think about softer PVC, like the fake leather that you might have clothes or furniture made out of, or things like Barbie dolls, with its kind of soft PVC, that will have a lot more plasticizer in it.
Now, under our forum post on this question over at nakedscientist.com/forum, user Alan suggests that exposure to heat and UV radiation can change bendy plastics to brittle over time. Is he right to say that? And if so, why?
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. Environmental conditions, heat, light, oxygen, all cause chemical reactions within the polymer. Those chemical reactions might break the chains down, which might make them more rigid or crumbly. It might make more crosslinks between the chains, which is going to make them more rigid. Or it might evaporate or leach out the plasticizer molecules. We had a feature in Chemistry World recently about preserving Barbie dolls, which are made of PVC, which has a plasticizer in, and they have all sorts of problems with the plasticizers coming out or the materials degrading. So if you want to then preserve those plastics, it's quite a challenge.
Are all plastics susceptible to this loss of bendiness over time?
Well, most flexible polymers will tend to become more rigid over time because they will age. But sometimes that's not the problem. Sometimes you can go the other way. The way the polymer degrades will make it more kind of sticky or more flexible in some ways. And there's quite an interesting story on that, which is in the 60s and 70s, there was a musical instrument called a clavinet, favorite of Stevie Wonder. If you know the song Superstition, that riff at the start, that's a clavinet. The hammers that hit the keys in that instrument, it's a keyboard, were tipped with a rubbery polymer. And over time, that polymer would become more sticky, and that changed the sound of the instrument. It went from a more hitting the strings to a slightly sticky plucked sound, which sounded slightly different. And there were various jazz musicians and some people who really preferred that kind of sticky plucked sound. So they would start to seek out instruments where the hammers had degraded enough to make that sound.
Chemistry and music history here on Question of the Week. Thank you so much to Philip Broadwith from Chemistry World and Jimmy for the interesting question. You can find links to some of the stories mentioned in this piece over on our website. That's nakedscientists.com. Next time, we'll be answering this question from listener Daniel. He asks, how do we know for sure that the laws of physics that humans have set down in ink are the same laws of physics that another civilization might have on another planet?
Thank you, James. Now, that is one big question I can imagine will spark quite a conversation over at the Naked Scientist Forum. You can go there at nakedscientist.com/forum, where they'll be discussing that and similar questions. Do please sign up and join in. And do be sure to drop us a line, of course, if you have a question of your own. You can submit that to chris@thenakedscientist.com. Meanwhile, don't forget that the Naked Scientists do rely on your generosity and donations to keep us on the road. So if you would like to support the work we do here on the programme, you can do that very safely and easily. It's at nakedscientist.com/donate, and we would be very grateful for anything that you can spare to help us. That's all we have time for this week. Do join us again on Tuesday when we're going to be taking a closer look at language and the science that goes with it. The Naked Scientist comes to you from the University of Cambridge's Institute of Continuing Education. It is supported by Rolls-Royce. I'm Chris Smith. Thank you for listening, and until next time, goodbye.